Thank you very much for those kind remarks. I'm almost embarrassed to stand up here, but I'll do my best to sing for my, well, not quite my supper, but I'll sing, I think, as best as I can. And also, my congratulations to Carol for putting together this event. I think the audience today shows that all the effort Carol has been well deserved. I offer my congratulations to you. Vertical communities, they work in Hong Kong. Title deliberately selected, particularly they work in Hong Kong, because just in the context of what we heard yesterday, I think I should perhaps, and Paul has echoed it already, issue what we might describe as a bit of a health warning, if you like. They work in Hong Kong, and they work in the context of Hong Kong, but they won't, and we know this, they obviously clearly won't work everywhere. And what I want to talk today about is principles, concepts, best practice, the ethos, if you like, of vertical communities, as against the detail, because the detail is very specific to Hong Kong. So I think we just need to bear that in mind when you see those very, very high-rise buildings that Carol showed you at the outset. We've seen lots of shots of Hong Kong. This is my picture of Hong Kong looking down at the numerous vertical communities that we have created in Hong Kong, which I'm going to talk about this afternoon. What are the drivers of verticality in Hong Kong? Well, clearly, and as you've heard and as you'll see when I show you again another map of Hong Kong, our topography. The reality is that we can't build everywhere, we can only build on a very limited area of Hong Kong, and that drives us to think and contemplate about vertical solutions. The political backcloth. Don't forget that Hong Kong until 1997 was a colony. We basically had to live within our environment, if you like. We're constrained by our environment, by the political environment. Now the boundary, the borders with China is becoming much more porous, but prior to 1997 we were physically constrained in terms of having to operate within our own patch, if you like. Rapid influx of immigrants, again I'll talk about this during my presentation, but when you suddenly have 2 million refugees flood across the border into Hong Kong, you are driven to think of intense and vertical solutions in order to house those people with some degree of acceptability. Land policy, again, I'll talk a bit about that later on, but in Hong Kong, we have a leasehold system. All the land is owned by the government, and they grant long leases of land. Government control the land supply in Hong Kong, although I think they would officially deny that. But through this control, they again drive, they have a high land value policy, and they drive the market to think about vertical solutions. Economic success, the model has proved itself. Many people in Hong Kong have achieved wealth, significant wealth, by participating in verticality, it is an economically successful model. And then, I hope my Chinese friends will not be too upset, but certainly in Asia and certainly in Hong Kong, there's an obsession with real estate, and being able to buy flats, buy into buildings, to many people, is a hobby. This is my map of Hong Kong. I'm not sure how well you can see it, but essentially, it's just to portray what Carol was saying earlier, that the majority of Hong Kong is either mountain or green, and that the opportunities for development are restricted really to the coastal areas. And again, that drives us to think about vertical solutions. Demographics, again, we've heard a lot about this already. 1,000 kilometres, 67% of the land mass, different figures have been quoted, but essentially between 60 and 70% of the land mass is either country park or green belt, taboo from a development point of view. We've only developed about 18% of our land mass to date. Again, it's been around the perimeter, if you like, of the mountain areas. Population nearing 7 million, so a bit short of the population of New York. But growth has slowed now. It looks as if, but for immigration, we could be slipping into negative territory, which is an interesting challenge for Hong Kong. And then, just in terms of the population split, half our population live in the urban area, another 30% live in new towns, and the rest in the new territories. Very quickly on history, we're a relatively new boy to the block. Hong Kong was established as a British settlement in 1841. In fact, Lord Palmerston at the time was not too impressed. He called it a barren rock, which has been a very valuable one, a barren rock for the British ever since. And it developed as a hub for trade with China. And whereas initially the British just possessed the island, in 1860 they also took possession of the Kowloon Peninsula. We've seen some fairly interesting growths in population. Population in 1851, obviously fairly low, 30,000. 1931 had grown through almost natural process, if you like, to 80,000. We then had a major leap, particularly again linked to refugees from China in 48. By 70, we'd reached 4 million, again, largely driven by refugees coming over the border from China. And since then, we've grown to a population of about 6.8 to 6.6 million. The drivers of this growth have largely been, as you can see there, two major influxes of immigration. 97, we reverted back to China, became part of China again, and we saw the establishment of the SAR. Just going back, a little bit of interest in terms of history. First, as I said to you earlier, we have a leasehold system in Hong Kong. All the land is owned by government, and they had their first sale in 1841. And I've just put up some information here for you on that sale. There were 35 marine lots, each having a frontage of 100 feet to Queen's Road. They were actually on the shoreline. Upset price in 1841 for a very valuable, what is now probably the most valuable sites in Hong Kong, was £10. And they had a number of successful bids which ranged from 20 to £285, depending on the location and the site depth. And the site of the current Hong Kong Bank, which many of you may have seen and know, is one of these sites here. Land tenure in Hong Kong, not dissimilar to what you have here in New York. We have a long leasehold system. As I said, the freehold is vested, if you like, in the government. Early in the peace, the British were very generous. They granted 999-year leases. Then they realised they were being too generous, cut it back to 99, then cut it back to 75, and today we're in a world of 50-year leases. That's deemed to be sufficient, if you like, for a developer to build, recover his cost, and make a significant profit. Indeed, within that 50-year period in Hong Kong, you probably knock the building down at least once in order to achieve greater profit. Influence of government, obviously, because government control land, because we have this leasehold land tenure system, government is very influential in the process, and indeed do control supply. They control supply in three ways. They sell land by auction or by tender, and we have an application list. We have a list of sites which are available for development, and the developers apply for these sites to be offered for sale. But that's not the main source of development in Hong Kong. The main source of development is through lease modification. Many of the original leases were granted for industrial purposes or non-high income producing purposes. And what the developers do, and do very successfully, is convert these sites, industrial sites or agricultural land, into higher value uses. And this is where at least 80% of our product, the vertical communities that you see, we'll see later, come from. And then we have agencies who are involved in the process, such as Urban Renewal Authority and the MTR, from whom we heard yesterday. Government very dependent on land revenues. At times, up to 30% of government's revenue can come from land sales or from lease modifications. So it's a very important component in the government's planning, and certainly from that point of view, they do have a vested interest, if you like, to control supply. They're also a major owner and provider of social housing, and I'll talk to you a little later about the housing authority and the fact that we have still in Hong Kong 700,000 families living in public rental housing. That's one third of the population. Larger question of history, but we still have that liability and responsibility on the community. Government leases are very simple. This is just the list of the main components of a government lease. Tells you what use you can put the land to, tells you how much floor area you can build on the site, tells you how much you're going to pay for that privilege. You pay up front, and this again drives to some to a large extent both land value and verticality. The developer, when he buys it, when he acquires a lease, has to pay the full price for the value of the land up front. And then there's a government rent and the various other clauses in the lease. People ask me, well, what happened after 1997? Well, the reality is that life went on, everything was through train, if you like, and we've seen that the leasehold system essentially run through the handover of Hong Kong back to China, so it's business as usual. One of the things that I think has enhanced and has made verticality, if you like, an attraction, certainly in Hong Kong, is the availability of strata title. People can buy pieces of buildings. We have, it's, I think you can call it condominium title here in New York, but in Asia we call it strata title. It means that you can buy literally a piece of a building. And so within a vertical tower, you have many owners, and they come and go, and they can sell their share, if you like, relatively easily. And then you see our residential leases, which will surprise you, are normally only 2 or 3 years, and then you have a transfer to another owner. No security of tenure, so unless you can bring your market rent with your landlord, you're looking for another flat. Land disposal system I've talked about. All new land is offered for sale by auction, by tender. In the early years, government used to produce a sales list, but now they have produced an application list, and the developers apply for land, and the sites are released, provided the developer agrees to underwrite a minimum price, and then the site is put up for sale by auction. Lease modification I've talked about, this is where leases are modified to permit more valuable and higher use, and the government extract again a major payment when leases are modified, representing the uplift in value attributable to the change of use. Land conversion, lease modification, normally comes about by the developer first getting the change of use recognised through the planning system. You'll then go to government and have the lease to get the lease modified, building regulation approval, as you would have here in New York. Most developers in Hong Kong, and particularly when we're talking about virtual communities, will apply to government to pre-sell the units. Can't sell at plan stage, but normally in Hong Kong, when you've got about one-third of the development completed, construction completed, you can apply to government for pre-sales consent. Enables you to accelerate your cash flow, enables you to get commitments fairly early in the process. And then when you've completed the development, you apply to government for a certificate of compliance, and once you have that, you effectively honour all the obligations under your lease. So that's a bit of background, if you like, on the land tenure system and the world that the developer has to operate in Hong Kong. I'd like now to talk, if I can, just about some of the vertical communities that we have created in Hong Kong. First of all, let me talk a little, if I may, about the work of the Housing Authority. 1953, we had a major fire, which you see illustrated here on the slide, the Shep Kip Mei fire. 50,000 people were made homeless. These were largely refugees who were living on hillsides in squatter, of course, squatter areas. This focused the mind, if you like, of government and on the community on the need to provide for these hundreds of thousands of refugees who come across the border from China. And we saw the creation of the Housing Authority, and we then saw the creation of a major, major machine, if you like, which over the last 30, 40 years has developed major, major investments in vertical communities in Hong Kong. And this just gives you an idea of what the Housing Authority has achieved over the last, since 53, provided 650,000 flats for 2 million people. That's the best part of one third of the population. They also, besides building, these are rental apartments. These are apartments which are leased at subsidised rents. One of the challenges we have now is mobility, that people are paying probably 10% of market rent, very comfortable, no inclination to move at all, no reason why they should move at all. And we have an issue on how we move people from public rental to private, and perhaps we could pick that up during discussion. Perhaps we're too generous on the original basis that people are allowed to take occupation. Housing Authority, besides building public rental, has also built flats for sale, subsidised sale, if you like, 400,000 units, starter homes, getting people on the ladder, probably paid 50 to 60% of market value to get on the ladder, but that's 400,000 families who are now provided with a modern roof over their head. The Housing Authority also provided loans to help people buy those flats, 100,000 loans, and Housing Authority also has built shopping centres at the heart of many of these housing estates. These have now been injected into REIT, but they were responsible for, as you can see, a very large commercial portfolio until recently. This is just a shot of showing you, this is what happened post 53, after the fire. This was Hong Kong's first attempt, if you like, to house tens of thousands of people, not particularly attractive, but the best that could be done at the time. Verticality began to come into play. These are not, again, particularly attractive shots, and of course this has long been superseded, but this was our first solution into vertical public housing, if you like. And then we got better. This is a scheme on Hong Kong Island. And these are some more modern shots of public housing in Hong Kong. As I said, these are leased at very, very subsidised rents. There are 700,000 flats now of this type and category. Here's something more recent, again, in terms of public rental housing. Private sector now. I've talked about the public vertical communities, if you like. Private sector, and this may surprise you, this is a pie chart which shows you the makeup of the million homes that are comprised in the private sector in Hong Kong. And it's not necessarily something that we're particularly proud of, but if you look at your Class A, that's 33% of our stock, there are units less than 40 square metres. If you look at the Class B, 49%, those are units of less than 70 square metres, so 82% of our stock is less than 70 square metres. Now that's one of the prices, and perhaps we can talk about this during discussion as well, in a way this is one of the prices you pay for verticality and for one of the prices of a high land value policy, that affordability begins to drive size and begins to drive what people can afford and what people can buy. And in fact, the size of our units in the private sector is now falling because developers realise that if they're to sell their product, they've got to aim at a market, as wide a market as possible, and the result is that they build smaller units because obviously they've got more chance of sale if the units are smaller. The 2% green that you see there, that's what we call our luxury sector. That's the sector that receives all the headlines. You've probably seen it reported in your New York papers when flats are sold for 8 or 10 million US dollars. Reality is the bulk of the world in Hong Kong, as I say, is under 70 square metres, and units there are probably selling at 200,000-300,000 US time. Also, we're looking at a very different situation in terms of our private sector vertical communities. We used to build 35,000-40,000 units a year. Because of the changing demographics, this is mass housing. This is our middle market. These are the units that the MTR so very successfully builds above its developments. This is what most private sector owners would aspire to in Hong Kong if they're able to buy a unit in Fa Tuen, or they're able to buy a unit in Telford Garden. Most people would feel that they'd achieve their objective. The luxury sector in Hong Kong, I've dealt with public, I've dealt with the mass market. In terms of luxury, well, you can see what's happened recently. There is no, in many ways, luxury, vertical living in Hong Kong, if you like. There is no problem, there's no resistance, if you like, be it at public level, be it at mass level, indeed be it at luxury level. You see here how the capital value indexes have risen dramatically over the last few years. No resistance to verticality at all. Indeed, values have trebled in the last 3 or 4 years in Hong Kong. not agree a New York version. This, as I said, that's why I gave you a health warning early on. This is the Hong Kong version of luxury. This is Leighton Hill. Many, many people aspire, ultimately, when they moved up the ladder from 40 to 70 to 100 metres, and this is your 150 square metres, this is where many aspire to end. And you see that, again, capital values have risen here as well. Bel Air, another luxury development where many aspire to settle, but here you are looking at $8 and $10 million in order to buy a unit. And then the Arch here in West Kowloon, again, an example of what Hong Kong would describe as a vertical luxury community on the waterfront. Then just moving on, if I may, to our another grouping of vertical communities, and that's our new towns. With the influx of refugees and with the pressure on the urban areas, the government was forced, if you like, to look at how we might adopt a greenfield solution to some of our vertical community problems, challenges, if you like. In the urban area, it was becoming increasingly difficult to find homes for people, particularly because of multiple ownership. I talked to you earlier about strata title, which is fine when you allow people to buy bits of buildings, but when you have 700 or 800 owners in a building and you have to work out how you're going to redevelop that building, it becomes very, very complicated. And in the end, government in many cases just said, this is too difficult, let us go off and look at some greenfield sites. And this is what they did in the new territories. So multiple ownership was a challenge. And then they had this was compounded by the influx of the refugees. So in 1972, the government decided to embark on a major housing program to provide homes for 1.8 million people. Largely, most of those, that more than half, were to be planned in the new towns. But again, linked to what was being discussed yesterday, that the policy and the plans and the program was very much linked to creating an integrated solution, comprehensive solution, involving not only new town development, but also transportation and thinking very much of an environmental solution as well. But the integrated comprehensive solution that Thomas Ho was talking about yesterday, extended, if you like, to the new towns. And in the case of the early new towns, the concept was not only to provide homes for people, but also to provide employment and self-containment, if you like, was part of the initial concept. But as I'll explain later, the bright lights in the urban areas proved too much of a temptation, and the idea of self-containment has not really worked too well. Just show you very quickly three new towns, give you an idea of what we've done in terms of vertical communities in the new territories. This is our earliest new town, Sha Tin, initially planned for 500,000, but now has a population of 750,000, 750 persons per hectare. Initially it was marshland and involved a fair element of reclamation. But it was anchored, and this is another thing we've found in Hong Kong, that the private sector will not lead in terms of new town development, they will follow. So it had to be led by government decentralisation, new offices, and indeed by local industry. That's Sha Tin in 1973. You can see the challenge in terms of reclamation and marshland. And this is where we are 20, 30 years later. Very serious attempt, obviously, to integrate vertical high-rise with green, with recreation, and to get the right balance, if you like, between the relevant demanding uses. Very serious attempt made and is made within our new towns to create what I describe as green lungs, provide areas of recreation. This is what they've done in Sha Tin, very successfully around the river. Here another shot. So it's not all high-rise, and indeed by having high-rise, it does enable you and does create a lot of space around the foot of the towers and within and amongst the towers to create some very interesting landscape areas. Newtown Chun Wan, again another large new town, 800,000 people. This is anchored, where Sha Tin was very much anchored around existing employment opportunities in the Sha Tin area. Chuan is anchored around our container terminal. But again, connectivity, the importance of public transport, it was always contemplated and indeed is connected to the urban area by the MTR and also has strong road links with the rest of the territory. So connectivity vital, particularly in terms of public transport. That's Chuan, the original site before development, and that's what we're looking at today. Again, careful attempts to create green areas within the tower complexes. And recreation and green and paths, etc., all part of the offer. Third new town, and then I'll move on to just wrap things up. This is Chuan Mun, current population 520,000, building up to 550. Again, this is pinned by River Trade Terminal. This is where we consolidate the cargoes that are going up into China via the Pearl River Delta. But again, as you'll see, it's served by the KCR, or was the KCR, now the MTR, in terms of rail provision. And this is just a shot of Chuan Mun town, south as it is today. Importance of public transport, I mentioned, this is just a shot showing the light rail system as has been integrated into this particular new town. Yuen Long, again, no description, but just a picture of a fourth new town. But again, careful creation of public areas, water features, etc., to balance the high-rise environment. High-rise living, I just put this in. This is just outside the school, showing the kids coming down the steps. Nice shot, I think. Fanling, another new town, which is, again, you see the links to public transport and to the road system. Planning vertical communities, just put this in just to show you that an awful lot of planning did and does go into deciding on the right balance between verticality and all the support facilities. This is just a model of one of the new towns at the planning stage. The challenges we found with the new towns, which I've touched upon already, but the areas that we found we had to address and do now address as part of the process is firstly the need to provide early, indeed it's almost part of the advanced contract, if you like, the infrastructure, the rail support and the rest, and education, hospitals, etc., to support these large populations. You need a catalyst, and it's not, as I said earlier, you cannot rely on the public, on the private sector to act as that catalyst and the anchor. Government has got to take the initiative, and it has to be public sector driven, and the private sector will then follow. Policy of self-containment that I mentioned earlier, very difficult to achieve in practice. Ideally, you'd like people to live and to work in the same locality, but in Hong Kong we found, and it is not Hong Kong the exception, that the pull, as I described, of the bright lights and the higher salaries in the urban areas were such that most of our new towns have in fact become commuter new towns, if you like, for the urban area. Most people live in new towns and commute into the urban area on a daily basis. So that part of the exercise, if you like, the jury's out, and we have not necessarily created the self-containment that we would have liked to have done. And what we've also found, and you see from a number of those pictures, is yes, we have strategies to provide green and other environmental priorities, but if you're looking at densities, FARs, of up to 8 times site area, then there are prices to be paid, and prices have been paid in terms of green and other environmental features. Very quickly, this just shows you the mix of our housing population now. The blue is the private sector, the red is the subsidised purchase, and the green is public housing. You see that's basically our mix, about a third of our population in public housing. 400,000 families in subsidised purchase, and then the rest is private sector. This is just by household, but again, the picture is not dissimilar. This is interesting. This is the total spend, not the total spend, this is the production of housing in Hong Kong over the last 20 years. peaking in the year 2000 when we built nearly 100,000 units. But as I said earlier, we're now down to between 12 and 15,000, so a very different world to the world 10 years ago. This I put out because I think it's interesting, because what we're seeing in terms of the public sector housing is that the space per person, 8.4 metres in 92 and 12 square metres in 2007, so we've seen a 50% increase in the allocation of space per person in the public sector, and that compares, as I said earlier, the situation where in the private sector we're finding that flat sizes are reducing, and obviously the space per person is reducing as well. So if we were to draw this line, a similar line to the line you see here, going up on the public sector side, we'd actually see it coming down, unfortunately, in a very similar way. So that's one of the challenges that we have to face in Hong Kong. And this is just the spend on housing in Hong Kong, public expenditure on Hong Kong, reaching a peak, as you see in, where are we now, 2000, of about $2 billion US in that one particular year. But again, significantly reduced in recent years. Just wrapping up, why does it work in Hong Kong? Well, I think, first of all, think of the alternatives. If we were to go horizontal, you'd be looking at probably a four-story sprawl across the whole of the territory, across the whole of your 1,000 kilometres. So the alternative is not a tenable alternative. You have to go vertical because of space constraints. There are opportunities to create wealth at all stages of the value chain. And I think this is part of the attraction of the model. Government makes money by selling land. Developer makes money by creating the development. And then obviously the flat purchasers, particularly if they buy at the right time in the curve, if you like, they then see capital appreciation. So it's certainly seen as a situation that creates wealth for all the parties in the process. Why it works in Hong Kong, again, back to MTR, the fact that they and indeed the government plan these integrated solutions where these major developments, the vertical communities, sit above the MTR and other public transport facilities. Synergies, convenience, efficiencies, again, we touched on this a lot yesterday, clearly by having vertical communities and sitting along above public transport and having them alongside commercial and other facilities, there are huge synergies to be gained. Pragmatism, in Hong Kong people are pretty pragmatic. And I think there is and that's one of the things we touched upon yesterday again, attitude, culture. People in Hong Kong accept vertical living, if you like, as part of the way of life. It's something they're brought up with and they live with, although it's fair to say, and we perhaps touch on this in discussion, there are growing concerns within the community, particularly as to the quality of life in many of our new towns. And then the role of government, obviously the government acts as a facilitator. Government allows these high plot ratios, and that enables obviously the developers to build vertical communities. Price that's been paid, just finally wrapping up. We paid a price, I think, in terms of height, and we paid a price in terms of plot ratio and density. You go vertical, and it puts huge pressures on the community in these areas. And there is a major debate now in Hong Kong about density, height and plot ratio, and I can touch upon that. Air circulation, certainly in some of the new towns there are challenges with air circulation and traffic pollution. Visual intrusion, you probably have gathered that from some of the slides that I've showed you. We've also seen, and this is unfortunate, but again I think it's true, an engineering-dominated approach to planning, and that again has changed now, but in the early days it was very much driven by engineers, and solutions were engineering-driven. We've paid a price, as I said earlier, in terms of unit size and affordability, and we've got this debate going on now within society about the balance between government maximising rent, land revenues, if you like, through land sales, and the value that society puts on intangibles, And there is a growing view in Hong Kong, certainly, that a much higher value will be put on the intangibles and perhaps less on the land revenue aspects. So those, if you like, are some of the, not the downside, but some of the issues that high-rise communities, vertical communities give rise to. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'll call you close. Thank you very much. Thank you.